I'm Shalina Tobin, and my guest today is one of the most talented chefs in Britain. With his Michelin-starred marriage of Japanese flavours and amazing Welsh produce, Gareth Ward has built himself a reputation of sophisticated innovation at his beautiful restaurant, Ynysir, in Machynlleth on the west coast of Mid Wales. Gareth, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to finally have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you. We actually had your home kit a few weeks ago. Phenomenal box. Really beautiful.
Which one was it? It was
the lamb with the couscous.
Oh, all right, cool. Yeah, with Banquist.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Great bunch of guys. Yeah, they do a really good job.
It's probably one of the best lamb dishes that we've ever had at home.
Yeah, it's good to hear that. A lot of people give it really good feedback, which means that they're doing their job properly. Because obviously a lot of these companies that you work with are like, get you to go and do a tasting with them and stuff like that, and like taste what they've produced on your recipes. They don't do that, which is sometimes a bit scary.
Right.
But obviously they're doing a good job because a lot of people say it's amazing. So yeah.
Yeah.
Good to hear.
That is interesting. I don't really know the background about how the home kits actually work. I thought it actually just comes from your place. So
no, not at all. I mean, so how it works is they contact us. They ask us if we're interested, and we say yes or no. And then it's kind of like, right, okay, what would you like to do as a menu?
Hmm.
And we give them a few menu options, and then they decide what menu they want.
Right.
And then they come here and film.
Okay.
So then, and we film the whole making the menu from start to finish.
Saw that.
Which you've seen. And then they go away and they cook it all.
So you provide them with the spices and the sort of marinades?
No, nothing. We provide them with a recipe.
Okay.
So they do it all themselves, yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Because a lot of people like get in touch with me thinking, oh, like, it's not us, it's them. They deserve the credit, not us. You know, obviously we've written the menu, but they're the guys that have put it together.
Yeah.
So it's great for them, really.
Pretty scary though. I mean, because you know, for you to put your name on a box and you're not quite sure how it's going to turn out, that must be pretty worrying.
It's working with the right people, isn't it? Like you've got like, who you're going to work with. Obviously, I trust them guys.
Yeah.
And I like them and I get on with them. So I know they're going to do a good job and their feedback is brilliant. You know, and same as there's the guys from Star Chefs, they do a box as well. And I actually went to do a tasting with them and what they produced was unbelievable. Like I thought it'd come out my own kitchen, you know, and it was that good. So it's kind of like you've got to work with the right people, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It is all about the team and that is absolutely teamwork. And so I think we're getting another box in a couple of weeks. We were just looking it up this morning, actually.
Tomahawk.
Yeah, the Tomahawk.
So hopefully you'll have a great time.
Is that with your special seasoning? Because I know you do a special seasoning for your steaks.
I can't remember if it was. Do you know what? It was that long ago I filmed that. I can't remember what it was with now.
Okay.
I'll have a refresh and I'll let you know.
Let me know and I can't wait. I'll let you know how it is.
So
Gareth, you had quite an unusual start to your culinary journey in the sense that you weren't really interested in cooking, were you?
No, not at all. I mean, I left school not having anything in plan, and the day I left school my mum was really strict, and I've had a brilliant upbringing by my mum, but she was very strict in throughout my life, and it was a case of sat me down as the moment I got home from school, and her words were, "You're a man now, you need to find a job because you're not living here for free." I hadn't even took my school uniform on. You know,
most parents are having chat about the birds and the bees, but you're getting a chat about working.
And it was, you know, she grafted all of her life really, really hard. And she looked after there was four of us in the house, but, you know, she was the only one that worked, and she worked really hard. I mean, sometimes she had multiple jobs to make it work, you know, and I saw her go through some really, really hard times, and there was no way she was going to let me get away with not going to work as soon as I could, you know. I mean, I always had jobs, throughout my young, like I did paper rounds on mill grounds. I worked on farms. You know, I did. I love to work. I love working it. You know, it's, I don't like sitting in the house. I want to be at work all the time. A bit like her, really. So I was like, I was never going to not do anything, but it was a case of what do I do when she pulled me and said, like, you need to find a job today.
And so what like, did you do? Did you go straight into a kitchen from there, or did you do something else?
No, I wanted to go in the army, first of all.
Okay.
Couldn't get in because I've got double vision. And back then, like, it was quite a strict pattern. I mean, now I think it doesn't matter what's wrong with you. I think you get in the army with three legs nowadays, you know what I mean? But, yeah, it's because obviously the soldiers are quite, it's quite tight now, isn't it? But then it was quite strict, you know, you had to be have good vision and everything. I have double vision, so I passed my eye test, you know.
Right.
And I wanted to go in the fire brigade, and at the time when I was leaving school, there was lots of strikes going on and protests to do with the fire brigade, and they weren't recruiting. And then I thought, well, I don't know what else to do. And I had a chat with my uncle, who's my best, but he's like my dad, you know, like he kind of brought me up as a dad. He's my dad, sorry. And he was, why don't you be a chef? And I was like, well, why would I want to do that? I hate food. I mean, you wouldn't tell now. But I didn't really eat anything. It was just very plain, you know, and I wasn't interested in food at all. And
I heard you were a picky eater.
Oh, very, I was, yeah. I mean, not anymore, no. But it was very picky, yeah. And he was kind of like, doesn't matter what kind of level you work at as a chef, you will always have a job because everyone needs feeding, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so it's whether it's at the highest level you can go or the lowest level or on a cruise ship or whatever, in the army as a chef or whatever you do, like you'll always, people need feeding. It's a thing. It's just the way of life.
Yeah, cool.
And I was kind of like, yeah, you're kind of right there, really. So my mum took me to the careers office and they asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to be a chef. And she nearly fell off a chair. She was like, you what? Like, where's that come from? You've never ever said that before. And then like a couple of days later, I was working in a pub called Seven Stars in Chingcliffe.
Amazing.
And and I was doing like obviously usual washing up, you know, as you were, you start at the bottom.
You're a KP first, and
yeah, you wash up and you clean up and you just basically get raw all the time.
So you were 18 at this point, or were you younger?
I left school quite young. So I'll have been 17 at the least. Mm-hmm. Late 16, early 17.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite, I was young, you know, it was hard.
Yeah, very young. So you said you started off as a KP. How long did it take you to progress from there?
Well, it's kind of both. You did a bit of both. So you did give it KP in, and then you did a bit of cooking as well at the same time. It wasn't just went into KP. I went in as an apprentice. Right. At NVQ, I did a work-based NVQ. So they put me through they used to come in, the teachers used to come in once a week or once a month, whatever it was, and they used to spend the day in the kitchen with me and watch me work and fill my forms out and stuff like that. So it's all government, like, proper done. But, yeah, you do a bit of everything, don't you, when you're young. You've got to wash up, you've got to do clean up, you've just got to do everything. It's just part of Barcelona being the guy at the bottom of the pile, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I heard that at Seven Stars, I mean, your perception of food and cooking completely changed. So talk to us a little bit about how those changes happened.
Well, I mean, I started to taste food and think, wow, it's all right, that I quite like it. Like, things, it's different, isn't it? Because like a lot of people say, oh, I hate this, I hate fish, or I hate this, or I hate that. Sometimes the only reason why people hate it is because they've had it cooked wrong or they've had poor quality. That's normally. I mean, you do get the odd one to say, I just don't like it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a huge fan of oysters. I love them when they're cooked, but I don't really like them when they're raw. And it's not because I've eaten rubbish raw oysters. I've eaten the best raw oysters in the world, but I just don't like them. You know, but a lot of people will say, oh, I don't like fish. I hate all fish. And then they'll come, like, I get them at the restaurant here and you'll, like, the first 10 courses of my menu was fish, so you have a fish today, regardless whether you like it or not. Because we don't change anything for anybody. And then at the end of the 10 courses, they're like, do you know what? I ate every one of them. It was amazing. It's right. Because it's quality for a start. We're only buying the best. And it's done properly. You know what I mean? Because we know what we're doing. Mm. And that makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, of course.
So it's like when I started tasting stuff that was done properly, I was like, oh, that's really nice. That's not my grandma's like 3-day cooked pig's liver. That's a beautiful piece of like pan-seared calf's liver. That's delicious. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not green and it's not drying my mouth out. You know, because that's your perception of liver, isn't it? If when you've had it when you were a kid and you've had it cooked by a parent who's like literally left it in the oven for 3 days and it's like sucks all the moisture out of your body when you put it in your mouth.
Oh, bless.
You know, yeah, that's liver. That's like liver, and you just put that in the category of liver and you don't like it.
Yeah.
But if you eat it done properly, you're like, do you know what? That is actually quite amazing.
So this is really interesting. So basically, you didn't enjoy your food while you were growing up. I guess it just wasn't part of your family sort of culture.
I mean, we were family. We didn't have any money. Mum did well, you know. My mum's not with us anymore, unfortunately. You know, but I still remember some of the food that she cooked and how it tasted. She had a special, like, two dishes that was amazing. One of them was like a chicken curry, and the other one was a spaghetti bolognese, and I can still taste them now, and I would love to eat it. Like right now, I would love to eat it. And they weren't anything special. They were just the way it was just my mum and she made it. You know, I mean, sometimes she would just make rubbish, you know, because we had nothing, you know what I mean? Like, and she worked hard and then she'd come home and have to cook as well. So it's not, and she wasn't on fire every day, you know what I mean? Like, she was tired sometimes and she just couldn't be asked, which is fair enough, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I mean, how many siblings do you have?
It's just me and my sister, and then there was my mum and my dad.
Right.
But that was it. But, it was just Northern family, grew up in Council State, you know, the usual. We didn't, like, I never went to a restaurant when I was a kid. You know, I think the first restaurant I ever went to, I took myself there. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like we'd ever eat out or anything like that. It just didn't happen. We didn't exist, you know. So, yeah, it was. So, as soon as I got into a kitchen and I started learning about food and started tasting, I was like, this is actually pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what really got you, because I think at the age of 16 or whatever it was, that was your first real encounter with proper food and different flavors. So, yeah. So you've really sort of, I guess, got really inspired by it. But so it's Alan O'Kane who helped you see the bigger picture and helped you apply to Gordon Ramsay's in Chelsea, is that right?
Yeah, so Alan came to work at Seven Stars with me, mm-hmm. and he became a good friend. And he was like, you know, he saw something in me. He was like, you know, for your age, like the Seven Stars was a busy, busy kitchen. We were doing like 300 covers on a Saturday night in this tiny pub. It was like turning the restaurant over three times, you know. And this little team we had there was class. Yeah, like the head chef was Mark Everson, who was brilliant. He was in the Northeast. He's a brilliant chef for what he does, you know. And like we were doing some good stuff. Like everything was cooked fresh, you know, like properly in a pan in the oven, you know. Like there was no water baths or anything like that back then. So it was proper cooking. And I was cooking, like I was on the, when Alan started at Seven Stars, I was on the stove, I was cooking the meat at like 17, you know, and he was like, everything you put on the pass is perfectly cooked every time. Mm. And you're doing that for 300 people. He's like, you've got a bit of a talent, like you're doing a good job, but like, you need to get out of the Northeast and you need to go and work in a Michelin star kitchen. And if you're serious about your career. And I didn't know what I was like, Michelin what? Like, what the fuck's Michelin star? You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know. I didn't have a clue. I just had, all I knew was pubs in County Durham, you know. I didn't have a clue about anything like that. So he bought me a copy of the Good Food Guide, which is my favorite guide in the world now, you know. And that's the guy that kind of like, it was like reading a Harry Potter book. You know what I mean? Like, you don't write books like that. Like, obviously, Good Food Guide do, but the rest of them don't. It's like guidebooks are normally quite boring. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the writing of the Good Food Guide. Like I said, it's a story, and you read about each restaurant. And I remember reading about Gordon Ramsay's, and I was just like blew me away. And I read about Hambleton Hall, which I ended up in the end. And it was just like this mystical place on this top of this hill, which is like a castle, you know. And it's just kind of, if you're a customer, when you read that, you're like, oh, I want to go and eat there. It sounds amazing. You know, and it tells you something. It gets you excited by it rather than going, yeah, they cook three courses. It's this much money. The head chef called this. And yeah, you go there between Monday and Saturday. And that's it. You know, it's like, okay, fine enough. I could have found that out online. You know, it's the, so it's, yeah, that, so Alan kind of got me interested in like looking, and I went to Gordon Ramsay's for a stage, and was just, it scared the shit out of me, to be honest. I was too young. I was like, I was 17. I'd never been out North East, you know, like, I went to London for 3 days and went into Ramsay's kitchen, and I've just never seen anything like it in my life. I was just like, holy shit, what is going on here? You know what I mean? Like,
well, that's the army is right there. So it was quite a militant kitchen, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. You could say that, yeah. It was just, I mean, it was unbelievable. Don't get me wrong. But it was just a different level that I wasn't ready for. I was just like, I think you've got to do a bit of levels in between before you get to that level. Like, jumping straight from a pub in the Northeast to one of the best restaurants in the world, I think you've got to take a few steps before you get to that level, I think. And it literally scared the shit out of me. I was like, I'm not ready for that. It's too much for me. Yeah. You know, so I went home and I was like a little bit deflated because I was quite excited about moving to London. But it just wasn't for me. So then the second choice was Hambleton Hall.
Yeah.
And I remember, walking in to the kitchen there and just feeling like overwhelmed, and it was just like, holy shit, this is amazing. And it just gave me a different, it was a bit more friendly, for instance. You know, yeah. You know, people there wanted to talk to you rather than just scream at you or stand on you. And it was just unbelievable. And I didn't do a trial there. I went straight because Aaron said to me, like, there's no point in driving all the way down here to do a trial. He's like, just come down, I'll take you on, you know, we'll do a 3 month trial period. In 3 months, if you're happy and I'm happy, we'll keep you on. If you're not, well, then we can move on and, you know, go and do something else. So I went down, and in the first week I was just like, this is mind blowing. Like, I was tasting things that I'd never tasted before in my life. I was seeing ingredients come to the door that I didn't know existed, you know, like, it blew me away.
Yeah, amazing. This is standard, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it should have in its heyday, it should have had two, in my opinion, you know, like the stuff that we were doing there. I can't understand for the life of me why it didn't ever get there. Aaron is an unbelievable chef and a close friend of mine, but his passion for food is second to none. You know, produce he was using it didn't matter how much it cost, it was incredible. And the dishes that he developed were just insane, you know, and the flavors and classical cooking. And yeah, and I had a great 5 years there, and he taught me how to cook. I obviously already knew a little bit, but he taught me how to cook properly and taught me about ingredients. That's where I really learned then two things from there, ingredients and cooking, you know. And now I have that here, like, it's all about ingredients at NSA. You know, we're using the best ingredients in the world. There is no expense spared on ingredients ever. You know, if it's local, it's local, but it's still the best. If you can't get it that good, if it's not world class from here, we go around the world and find it to find world class. And that is that's our philosophy, you know, and flavor and just beautiful cooking.
Mm. We're going to be talking about Inisir in a bit. I just wanted to kind of go over your history and just finish that part of the interview.
Yeah.
So you, like you said, you were there for 5 years before you moved to Seton Hall under Steve Smith, another Michelin-starred restaurant. How was that?
Yeah, I always said if after working in a star, I said if there's ever, I would love to go home and work under somebody who had a star, and there wasn't one at the time. And then it got close to me looking to move on, and I was starting to think, you know what, my time is coming up at Hambleton. I'd done my time there. I wanted to learn something new. And then the Michelin guy came out, and Steve got a star at Seton Hall. And I was like, wow, this is like obviously meant to be, you know. I've talked about this. So I rang him, and yeah, Steve's a cool guy, man. Like, he's doing something a bit different. He's mixing a bit of, at the time, I mean, he's, I don't know what, I can't remember, he's done his style now because I haven't really been to his restaurant, but he's mixing like classic with modern techniques. So it's a bit, it was like a good step because yeah, obviously Hambleton was very classic. And this was like the little jump in between.
Right.
So you learn classic techniques that he learned from like Marco and people like that, but then he's doing a bit of a twist on it with his modern techniques. So I went up there to see him and blown away by seeing Hall. Obviously, the time I saw it before then was it was a derelict building.
Right.
It was completely ruined. And then obviously, I think it was Tom Maxfield bought it and spent a fortune on it. And it was this incredible, like, best spa in Europe. Fantastic building. It's just like mind-blowing what they did to it. And I thought, yeah, this is going to be a great place to work. And working with Steve was great, but it was just a bad location. As in, like, I don't know if it was ever promoted properly. Because, I mean, now after being at Inisia, I don't think location matters. It's about how you push that location and what you make of your location.
Yeah.
I think if you make enough of it and you do enough there and you make it special, people will come. You know, and we've done that here. Like, this restaurant is full every single day and we're full until next year, you know, and then when we open the diary up, mate, for next year, hopefully that'll be the same again. Because we're doing something very different and people want to come and see what we're doing here. They're very interested. It creates like that buzz. And they didn't ever have that at CM, unfortunately, when I was there anyway. And it was like, it was just quiet. It was really hard work to get people in the restaurant. So unfortunately, it didn't really kick off. I don't think it ever really got anywhere massively. I think you had a couple of big names through the door, like Steve, and then Tommy Kenny Atkinson went, and you know, and it was like, but just didn't ever take off. I think it could have been much, much better than what it was. And I'm not sure who owns it now, but I think it's just a hotel with a quite average kitchen, I think.
That's such a shame, because I guess social media plays a really big role, I think, in promoting restaurants now as well.
I think if it had been now, it would be a different story. But only if it has the right people behind it. You've got to have the right people running it, haven't you, and pushing it. Like, I did until very recently. I did all of our social media here. And it really matters. Like, social media, well, I mean, I still agree with it, is a very, very powerful tool.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not personally, I've quit social media completely because of various reasons. But I do still believe it's a powerful tool, and I'll find out quite soon whether I've done the right thing or the wrong thing. but I've got to stick to my beliefs, and there's some things I don't believe in with what's going on social media. I think it's quite poisonous. I think it's gone the other way for me. It started off as something very positive and it's gone very negative. And my whole philosophy in this era is zero negativity. Negativity breeds failure. You know, it's like cancer. It's a spread soup. Like, you've got one tiny little bit of negativity in the camp, and before the end of the day, the whole place is negative. Everyone's mourning. So we don't allow it at all in the business.
So can I just ask for like specifics? I mean, what is it that went wrong for you? Because I don't really know. I don't know why.
Yeah, there was a. I had a Zoom. I had one of these meeting like interviews with a friend of mine, Michael O'Hare, who's one of my best friends.
Uh-huh.
And the staff canteen.
Yeah.
And we were just chatting and it was fun, you know, and I called a girl a bird and I got massive backlash from it. It wasn't meant to be offensive. I'm a nice guy. I'm not a male chauvinist pig. I've got nothing against women. I've got nothing against anybody in life, you know. I'm just a daft northerner, and that's what we call it. Unfortunately, that's just the way we're brought up, and that's like we all use words that we get from our local areas, you know. And I didn't mean it in any way offensive, but then it was taken hugely out of context. I mean, I can understand why, you know, and like if this lady had come to me personally and said, look, she really offended me. I would have been absolutely good. I mean, I was good when she said it. She was offended by it. Because, of course, I'm not, I don't want to offend anybody, you know. Like, I'm not in the business of upsetting people intentionally, you know what I mean? And I was quite upset by it all, but I got a huge backlash on social media about it. And I thought, you know what? This is not, like, what I'm on here for. I'm on here to push the business. But then I thought about getting rid of it then, and I was talked out of it. And then I was been watching one of my very close friends get some horrendous abuse on social media by people that don't even know who he is. This is the thing about it. Like, I got abused by people that don't know me. You know, never met me, don't know me. And then they call me everything. And I'm just like, you don't know me, man. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm watching my friends get abused that, like, from people that just don't know him, never met him, don't know who he is. And these same things about him, like, you have not got a right to say that about this guy. You don't know who he is, man. You know what I mean? And then a friend of mine put something up about him, and I was like, right, that, I called him straight away and said, you need to take that down right now because you don't know this guy and I know you, and that is ridiculous. And then I put a post up, and it was like, it all kind of happened in three, really. I put a post up of the kitchen having a great time in service, and someone chipped in going, or someone, one of your chefs has just dipped a finger in something. I'm like, you know what? Like, if that's what you're looking for in that post, like, we've just come back from being closed for 12 months. I'm showing you that my kitchen is back and having great time and fun, and we're all here and we're getting on with life. And if that's what you're going to sit there and say, I'm not doing this anymore. Because it's just not. Like, I remember the day when you couldn't comment on Instagram. It was just pictures. And there was no comments. And that was how amazing was that? You know what I mean? Like, I think it should be still that now. You know what I mean? Because I don't want to hear, like, unfortunately, there's people sat at home that are just very negative, bitter people that only want to say bad things. You know what I mean? Well, I'm sorry. I don't want to hear it. I'm not bothered. You know what I mean? It's just like, so we don't let negativity in our business, and I don't want it in, and I'm letting it in through my social media. And I thought, you know what, I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I'm really sorry about that. I had no idea, but, you know, things can get taken out of context so easily. And I did listen to that interview with Michael O'Hare. I thought it was a great interview. I loved it.
You know what? We were in lockdown. Really fun. Everyone was going through absolute shit.
Yeah.
And it was like, let's give everybody a laugh. Let's have a laugh.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was brilliant.
You know, and it's just like the backlash of it was unbelievable. And I was like, what? Like, I'm not known in the industry as a nasty chef. I'm not known as one of the guys that is ruthless. You know, I'm known as I'm just Gareth, this daft lad from up north who lives in Wales and does crazy shit. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what we're known for. I just didn't understand it.
Okay.
But I don't understand the world we live in nowadays, to be honest.
Yeah, well, just for the record, I'm glad that you're doing this interview. Thank you so much for agreeing
experience. It took me a lot, to be honest with you. I was on the fence.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because I thought to myself, I don't want to put myself in another situation.
Yeah, cool.
Because I don't, like, I can't help the way I talk. It's where I'm from. And I can't help the way. Like, I haven't been to a linguist specialist to learn how to speak properly. You know what I mean? This is the way I talk. This is the person I am. Like, if you don't like that, I'm really sorry. Don't have a go at me about it, because I don't have a go about where you're from. You know what I mean? And that's as simple as that. But I hate the world we live in nowadays, to be honest.
It can be very judgmental, very quick.
I'm not on social media anymore now, and that's what kind of swung it for me with this.
That's a shame, because
I won't see what people say about me, so it's fair enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not unless it gets written in the national newspaper, and I doubt that's ever going to happen.
it is a shame, just because, you know, you shouldn't stop what you're doing because of someone else's opinion of you. And
I just focus more on my job, you know, and my life and my children and my family. Yeah. You know, and it's just, do you know what? It's since I've come off it, I've realized how much I was actually on there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I've never had an addiction before. But for the past 4 weeks, I feel like I've been weaning myself off an addiction, which is bad. And I've told people this and they've gone, holy shit. And maybe it's time for me to look at what I'm doing as well. Because you don't actually realize how much time you're spending with your face glued to a mobile phone screen, watching what other people think about you and what you'll do. And you do, it feels like I've come off on it, something like either drugs or alcohol or whatever. You know, it's crazy, but I feel better for it now.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And I don't even know where my mobile phone is right now. I keep using it. So I'm not using it anymore.
So maybe it's a blessing in disguise then, kind of.
Oh, massive. Yeah. Massively. Yeah, because my son, like, or my kids would be like, they'd want a hug or they'd want to play with something or they'd want to chat with me and I'd be on my phone. You know, and you don't realise it. They'll come and say something to you and then you'll not answer them and then they'll just walk away. And now you spend every minute with them because you've got all the else. Yeah, it's crazy, you know. And in fact, I mean, I'm not trying to tell people what to do, but people need to look, man, how much time they're spending on social media because it's doing nothing for you and it's doing everything for them.
Yeah.
Because it is just a con, isn't it?
Right.
Well, let's not get into that anyway.
I think we did get into it.
Yeah, we did, yeah. Well, I don't think I said anything bad anyway. Nobody said to me, like Amelia listens to or reads or watches everything that I do. She's like my safety net and she'll come back and tell me if I've done something wrong. You know, she'll be the one. She's like, guys, because I don't listen to anything I do. I don't watch, I never watch myself on TV. I don't read anything about myself. I'm not interested. You know what I mean? Like I'm a stay level, grounded. I get on with my life and that's it. You know what I mean? Like, but if she says to me, I think you need to read this, guys, because I'm not sure if you've said the right thing or not. And then I read it, or I think you need to watch this because I think you might have messed up a little bit. You know, she keeps me right, you know, and that's all I need.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But she never said to me, you've messed up there. I think you've been a bit, I think you might offend people with that.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things Michael said were far more offending than Matt Lass said.
You know, I was going to say there were a lot more kind of risque things in that interview.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it started off very risky, so I'm baffled.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway.
It's an easy target, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, as they say, I think it's a time thing. People are going to forget about it and they're going to move on to the next thing that's, you know, that's going to irritate them. So it'll pass. And I'm glad that you've seen, you know, there's been a little bit of silver lining for you in all of this, you know.
Yeah,
you're right, yeah. It's great. Yeah. So let's get back to the interview. So we were talking about your time at Seaham Hall. You moved on to the Hearts in Nottingham. But what I really want to talk about is your time at Sat Baines. So you worked as sous chef for 3 years. This is where I've heard you say that you learned how to think about food differently. Talk to us about those kind of changes. So you've gone from a pub to Michelin star cooking to now Sat Baines. Talk to us about the difference.
So obviously, like I said before, was at Hambleton and I learned how to cook. I learned how to appreciate ingredients and use the best ingredients. But what Sat teaches you is something completely different. He will teach you how to get flavour out of stuff that you didn't know had flavour in it. You know what I mean? Like, the guy's a genius with flavor, and he's an unbelievable chef to work for. And he just opened. It's like, imagine there's a circle and everyone's in that circle, and that's classic cooking in that circle. And you can't make a souffle any different to what that recipe says, and that's the only way you can ever make it. And it's like, you don't ever break that rule. That is the rule. You go there, and it's just like, fuck that, we're not working in that circle, we're going to work on the other side of it. You know, and like, that's not the only way. Yeah, that's not the only way we're going to make that souffle. We can definitely make it a different way, you know. And that's kind of like how it is. It's like, there's no rules in cooking there. It was like extracting flavors and doing techniques how it worked best for them. And it's like learning how to just completely the open it opened my mind to food. Where you think there's like, that's the recipe. Don't ever, ever differ from that recipe. That is what you make. Come back to me when it's finished. Give me a taste. There, it's like, it was always changing. It's always like moving. It's always trialing. It's always seeing what we, where else we can go. And just come, yeah, just open my mind up to flavors and food. And when you've learned how to cook already and you know how to cook, you know, then when you learn that skill as well, you feel pretty confident in life that you're going to do something quite good. You know, like if you, because a lot of chefs out there don't, I've always said to my boys, like, at some point in your life, you need to go and work in a classical kitchen or as classic, like now it's quite hard because obviously there isn't that many of them. You need to go somewhere and learn how to cook properly. You know, forget about the water baths, forget about all the rest of it. Get a pan in your hand, turn your oven on, you know, get the grill on and do some cooking, you know, because like if I had a power cut here, like which we have had many of, because where we live is really prone to other power cuts, I could still cook the whole menu in a pan, you know, in like on a barbecue. And a lot of people will be like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? I haven't got my backpack machine and my water bath. How am I going to cook that piece of meat to 65 degrees? You know what I mean? It's like, well, we could still cook everything, you know, and that means a lot to me because I think everyone should learn how to cook properly before they start pushing. Because you get a lot of people that start trying to do loads of crazy stuff, but you've got to have the base for that. You know what I mean? There's the classic base to everything that you do in the kitchen, you know, and you never forget them classic ways and classic techniques, even though they only exist a tiny bit, it's still there, you know? So that's what he taught you anyway. That's what he taught me. I came out of there a very different chef to what I went in.
And I've read up on Zach Baines. He's a very inspirational character.
Yeah.
I've never had his food, but I really would love to.
I've never had his food either. Yeah, I'd love to eat there, yeah. Zach, you know what I mean? Like, he is who he is. He's very strong-minded. He's a legend, you know, he's a great chef and I owe a lot to him, you know, like I wouldn't be where I'm at now without my time there. Mm-hmm. Definitely not. Wouldn't be the same chef, wouldn't have this restaurant, wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. You know, I'd never really tried Japanese ingredients or ingredients before or techniques until I got there and I just like completely fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is the kind of food these are the ingredients that I want to use, you know, and then I started eating in a lot of these restaurants. I started spending a lot of time in Thai or Japanese or Chinese or Korean, eating that kind of food, like falling in love with it, thinking that's the kind of food I want to cook. That's what really, really turns me on. That's what really gets me going, you know, and then we've created our own style here, which is, you know, we're very much our own restaurant. We don't follow anybody else. We don't take techniques from anywhere else. We just do our own thing. And it's a very, very, you'll get a one-off meal when you come here.
So you moved to Unasir afterwards. Tell us about how the opportunity came up. And I mean, did they headhunt you?
What happened was I worked, when I'm looking for a job, obviously not anymore because I've got my own business now. But when I did look for jobs, I worked with a guy called Gary Beck, Red Star Recruitment, who was a great friend of mine. And in my opinion, he was the best. He's the best recruitment out there. Like he's not full of shit. You know, quite some of them are. You know, and he will tell you honestly whether it's the right job for you or not. And he wants you to stay there. He doesn't want to be moving you on in a couple of months' time. You know, it's not his gig where some of them do. You know, he wants you to stay there and he wants you to make him proud. Like he wants to see you get 2 stars or whatever. He wants to see you do really well. And you know, because it looks good on him, it looks good on his business, you know. And he does recruit and place some of the best jobs in the country. So I worked closely with him, and I left SAT and I spent about 8 months temping while we were looking for the right job. And it did get really frustrating, but I believed him 100% that he would get me the job that was right for me, you know. And I went for some interviews, and it was I either didn't get the job or I didn't take the job, or he would say it's not for you, you know. He wouldn't send me out if it wasn't for me. I'd call him up and say, have you seen this such and such jobs just come up? And he'd be like, not for you, mate. I'd be like, oh, but it looks really good. And he'd be like, honestly, trust me, that job is not for you. You'll spend 3 months there and you'll leave. You know? That's honestly, he could have placed me there because he's going to get money. He's going to get a fee.
Yeah, absolutely.
He could have gone, fuck it, we'll get Gareth there. We'll get the biggest salary we can get him. I'll take my fee. I'll move him on in 3 months when he doesn't like it or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, he could have put me there, but he didn't because he was looking for the right thing for me. And then I got the call. I was temping at Lords of the Manor. And I got the call one night. I remember I had the night off and he called me and went, it's landed, chef, the job. And I was like, where is it? And he's like, I can't tell you, but this is the job for you. This is the one. And I was like, mate, you've got to tell me. And he's like, I can't tell you because like it's all very hush-hush at the moment. And if I tell you, obviously, you might tell someone. I said, mate, I'm not going to tell anybody. Just tell me, man. Took me ages to get out of anywhere. And he says, oh, Innisfail in Wales. I was like, never heard of it. And he's like, what? What do you mean you never heard of it? I said, mate, I've never heard of it before. And he's
not
like,
in the good food guide.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a good food guide, but he's like, he says, oh, wow. He says, I thought you would have heard of it. It's quite like famous in the industry. Mm. I was like, I've never heard of it. I've never been to Wales, mate. Anyway, came down for an interview and was just blown away by the place. You know, and this, and he was right.
It was a 9-hour interview.
Yeah, literally, I drove down and I think I ended up staying the night in the end. Got chatting to the bot, like Reens, who had it at the time, and just took it, just like we clicked straight away. Like it was, I knew it, like the job was going to be there. Yeah, and it was just, that was it. And I was here a week later. But this is like, it chose me, you know, this was the place. He was right, this was the place. And then obviously, yeah, the rest is history, isn't it?
So you met Amelia at Sat Baines, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Amelia, just for everyone, just so that everyone knows, is your partner. So she's come with you now to Innisfail, is that right?
Yeah, it took me a while to convince her, yeah. But it was like literally... It happened quite weirdly, actually. She's like done 3 degrees as an architect. Like she's amazing. 10 years at university, or whatever. And on the week that she did it, passed her final degree, she started working here. She hasn't ever done really anything else in architecture. Than that.
Oh wow.
I feel quite bad to be honest. But what happened was that, of course, the story is like I was obviously employed by the Reens who were running in here. When I came here, I was working under them for 3 years, and then Mrs. Reen became very ill. We needed somebody to come and run the ship while she was in hospital, so Amelia was the obvious choice because she worked in obviously at SAT, which is a high level before, and she was my partner, which obviously helped. You know, she spent a lot of time here anyway, so yeah, we kind of got her in. And then Mrs. Reen died. So it was like her husband sold his shares to John Talbot, who was their business partner. He owns the building. He owns Innisfail. And then he asked me to stay. You know, I was like, because I was going to leave. You know, I was like, well, my time's done. And he was like, well, Innisfail is you now. Like you've built up a reputation. You know, people coming here to eat your food. Like, I want you to stay. And then we thrashed it out and, you know, and we turned it from I wasn't interested in running a 7-day-a-week relish at a hotel. It didn't do anything for me. Like, I'd had enough of hotels and all that business. You know, I saw in this place what I saw at Tats, which was a quirky destination restaurant with rooms, which was doing something very, very different. And that's what I saw in this. And that's what it is now, you know, and that's what we've built, like, John went with it, and he's an absolute legend, John. You know, like, he's like a father figure to me. He's like really, really brought me through business and really helped us. And like, he hasn't stopped us in any way of doing anything. He's just let it grow what we want to do. And he's, you know, I feel very, very lucky to have the opportunity that we've had here through him, because a lot of people would be very involved with where their money was going, you know, and very opinionative on what we could do with it. And he hasn't. He's just let us get on with it, you know. And sometimes he's walked to the door and he hasn't spoken to me for a few hours. You know? But then he's come around and gone, you know, I do like it. Yeah, it's actually really cool. But obviously, it's a very it's a very jigsaw puzzle development stage. Like, it's not, we haven't closed the doors and reopened as in a say a restaurant and rooms. We closed the door, we went to bed one night as a hotel and we woke up the next morning as a restaurant and rooms, but we still had customers in from the hotel. And it's been a very, very long changeover period where obviously we've got rid of the customers that were coming for the hotel and we've brought in the new customers that are coming for the restaurant. Very, very different people, you know, and the development, you know, changing the way the place looks is like, we can't just close the door and do it all in one go. We haven't got that kind of money. It's been very, a little bit at a time, and we still got a long way to go to make it what we want it to be, but we're getting there, you know, and it's because of him that we can do what we do, you know, and it's, I'm very, very lucky to have him behind me.
It sounds like it's just really, it was really meant to be, and your headhunter probably knew it the whole time.
Yeah, and probably, yeah. Well,
did you guys get shares in the business?
Yeah, so we're 49% shareholders now.
Oh,
so
amazing.
It's you know, this is us, like our business partners, it's obviously John and Jenny.
Yeah.
They're amazing. You know, like, I think I am the luckiest guy, like, to be honest. I'm really, really, I feel really lucky. And yeah, they just keep giving and just keep supporting, which is amazing.
Amazing. You know? You guys are flourishing. So Amelia was the architect for the redesign, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, we do everything together. I'm not, she's kind of all the credit, you know what I mean? Yeah, we do everything together. It's a partnership. We, you know, like, I'll have a great idea or she'll have a great idea and then we see it through. Normally, we very much doers and not talkers. So if we don't ever talk about anything that we don't intend to do. So it's like a lot of the things that we talk about gets done, you know, like, and if it doesn't get done, well, it wasn't meant to happen. So everything kind of happens like very much unplanned. It's just like, can we knock that wall down? Yeah, let's do it. And then in a couple of weeks time, the builder's in to taking the wall down.
Awesome.
You know, and that's kind of how I love to be. I hate standing around talking about stuff and then it never happens.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like, right, if we're going to do it, let's do it now.
Yeah.
Let's not wait, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like, and yeah, it's class. I love it. I just love the whole, the whole running a business and changing something, you know, and not
making
just
it
cooking.
Your own.
Yeah, not just cooking, you know what I mean? Like, it's not just about cooking anymore. Yeah, obviously cooking is my job and I love cooking and I'm in there every day, but it's running a business is really exciting. You know what I mean? And changing the way something looks and making it into a destination, making it into an experience. You know, like when you come here, it's more than just the food, it's the whole experience.
Yeah. And we touched on this earlier on. Ynysir is a very remote location in Wales. How do you convince people to come and visit?
We just do what we do and then hope that people see it and go, I want to go there. We don't really push much with market and stuff like that. Obviously, we're very lucky to have people behind us like James Martin, who's a close friend of mine, who believes in it and absolutely loves it here. And when he believes in something and loves it, he pushes it. And yeah, he has, you know, there's a few moments where it's been like either James Martin or MasterChef or Grace Dent. There's like, I'd say them three triggers have really put this place on the map, because there's been three people or three sets of people that have gone, this place is incredible, you need to go. You know, but then they've all got very big followers and very big voices in the world of food.
Right.
And it's created a spark, you know. But James is the number one, because he just keeps on pushing and seeing and keeps on what we do.
You on James Martin Saturday morning. My hubby is the chef in our house, and he was glued to the telly that day. Used your koji as a marinade on the wagyu steak, and
it's amazing.
But you could see there's such a great relationship between you and James, and it works really well for TV. And yeah, you were brilliant.
Yeah, we've just got a huge respect for each other. I think he loves what we do here and I love what he does, you know, we do two completely different things, you know, and we just get on. Yeah, we just get on really well. And, yeah, I love the guy. He's unbelievable. And I've got, I owe him a lot. He's done a lot for us, you know.
Yeah. So talk to us about your menu. It's 20 courses, is that right?
Actually 30.
Is it 30 now? Wow.
Yeah.
So they're all just kind of very bite-sized.
Yeah, it's no more than one or two mouthfuls.
Okay, so talk to us about, I know we've got a very strong sort of Japanese influence in there. Talk to us about the kind of flavours and, you know, what can one expect when dining with you?
So you're going to get an experience, a very, very fun experience, very laid back, chilled. We've got a DJ, so he plays a record, full of vinyl set every night.
Oh, wow.
Creates a great atmosphere. It's about coming to have fun. We don't want it to be stuck up or pretentious. It's about you come here, you let your hair down, you have fun, and you eat 30 courses of flavour. You know, I want you to have best ingredients you've ever had. So like I said before, we buy in the best, you know, we buy, it's Japanese Wagyu A5. You know, it's not Welsh Wagyu or Highland Wagyu or wherever, you know, like there's nothing wrong with them things, they're amazing. But Wagyu translates into Japanese beef, you know, that's what it translates into. So if you're going to use Wagyu, you use proper Wagyu, in my opinion. That's just my opinion, you know, like, and I love the guys at these other places. They are producing some incredible stuff, you know, but if you want to use Wagyu, then if you use it, it's insane. You know what I mean? And that's what we use. We've got the most incredible local shellfish. That doesn't get any better. You know, we're using scallops and prawns from Scotland, which are just, obviously, we all know how good them are, you know. Yeah. So it's just like about, yeah, there's no expense spared with ingredients. You're going to get the best ingredients that you could ever have on a menu with great music, and the flavours are just like insane. So it's all about like just punching you in the mouth with flavour. I don't believe in like pretty bland food. It doesn't do anything for me. You know, so like you get something in, say that we have a raw shrimp Thai green curry on the menu, which is just like one spoonful of this curry with the raw shrimps that come out the dovey, which is behind us, like the bit of waterway behind us. And they're just like these beautiful, fatty, sweet, awesome little shrimps, you know, with this insanely intense curry sauce. And it's all about flavor, yeah. Just
having making a good time. My mouth water. It sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Is there any? Do you ever have any courses that are often requested to come back again?
Well, I mean, people come back. Yeah, we don't change our menu that often. We change with seasons when there is something in season that I want to use, and we try and perfect the 30 courses that we do. We want to make them unbelievable. It's kind of my mission to make every one of them, because every day, them 30 courses are being looked at like one at a time and going, how can we make that better? Mm. You know, it's not about changing the menu every day. Mm. Like, hats off to people that do that. There are people out there that will change the menu every day, you know. Hats off them to have that much inspiration, like that idea, them many ideas, you know, because I don't force development. Like, if I have an idea every 6 months or every 2 days, that's kind of how I feel, you know. I won't sit there and go, I must change a dish today.
Right.
How am I going to do it? And then, because I feel it's a bit forced,
okay.
And it's not always your best, you know. Where if you've had an idea and it is incredible, well, let's do it. But then let's work on that. Like, how do you make that better? So you have that green curry. Now, where do we go? Like, do we find a better chili, or do we find a better pepper, or do we find a better prawn, or do we find you know what I mean? That's how I look at it. So you take that dish, which is great, but then how do we make it unbelievable?
Yeah.
And that's what we do with a lot of the dishes here.
The one specific dish that you would say is your absolute favorite, it almost sounds like, I think if I could guess, it sounds like the curry, because you've mentioned it.
No, it's not. I just keep bringing it up. it's hard, because like everyone says, oh, which is your favorite dish in the menu? It's like trying to pick your favorite child. You know, like that's how close you are to your dishes.
Secretly,
on the menu.
Secretly, you got one favorite.
Yeah, but I've got three kids and I love them all for different reasons.
Yeah, same.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't love any of them more than the other. I love them all. They all do different things. Yeah. And like, I mean, there's the dish that's blown everybody away at the moment on the menu, like in the customer's point of view, is we get the lobsters, local lobsters. And I'm not a massive lobster fan. I think they're a bit overrated. But, you know, this guy turned up with them after the whole Brexit thing and lockdown. He was like, I can't sell them. You know, so we've tapped into a market locally that we've never had before because everything's normally just gone abroad. Where now we can get everything because you can't sell it anymore.
Mm.
So we're getting these lobsters and we put them in the minus 80 freezer.
Okay.
And it just breaks them down, man. And changes the sugars in them and just like makes them like unbelievably tender. And you can remove them from the shell without actually having to blanch them in any way. So it just kind of releases the membrane from the shell. It means you can take the lobster out of the shell raw. And it's safe to eat raw because it's been frozen at minus 80, so everything's killed. So it's like perfectly safe. So it's like sashimi grade, basically. And then we're mincing it. So we're banging it through a mincer. And then so you've got like a paste. And then we're just spreading it on the bottom of a bowl. And then we're making this incredible, like, authentic Nanjing dressing. So Thai, really hot, spicy, sweet, salty, loads of coriander. And then doing a roasted lobster oil with all the shells and everything. And splitting that dressing with the roasted lobster oil. And that's it. And you just spoon that over last minute and eat it straight away. And it literally is blowing people's minds. People are just like, that is... It's so simple, but, like... So much flavor and the texture is obviously insane, you know. Yeah, and it's just. And I'm not scared of spice. You know, a lot of restaurants you go to won't use chilies and stuff because they know it shouldn't be in the fine dine restaurant. But fuck that, man! I've used loads of chili, mate. I'll blow your head off.
Sounds amazing. I heard you've got your own Himalayan salt cellar to enhance meat as well.
Yeah, salt chamber, full wraparound. Yeah, we've had it for 6 years now, I think. It was a massive investment because they were expensive, you know, and I hummed and hard about it for ages. And I thought, like, we've got a lot of money to spend on other things, like 20 grand on a fridge is a lot of money. But we did it, and it's like, because I love aging, and I love the whole thing about aging meat and fish. And this is just, it's a game changer.
Can you talk to us a bit about how that works? So I say I know nothing about it. Tell me how that works. How does the salt, it's the salt that ages it, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there's like a lot of people think they're aging stuff by just banging it in the fridge and leaving it there a long time. You're spoiling, you know, there's a big difference between spoiling meat and fish and aging meat and fish. You've got to have the right atmospheres and everything to age properly. You go in my aging fridge and it doesn't smell. It's clean. You know, there's no mold. It's all dry. Everything's dry as a bone, and everything it looks really good and doesn't smell. That's the difference. That's aging meat properly. You know, if things are sticky and horrible and smelly, that's spoiling, and that's not what you want. You know, so yeah, the salt just keeps everything right, keeps all the bacteria right. Obviously, you do get a little bit of residual salt on the meat, which can season, but I mean, I've never really seen that. It just dries, obviously the salt dries, helps dry all the meat out. So it's sucking, constantly taking moisture out of the air, and your bricks get really wet because it's just absorbing all the moisture. So your bricks get wet instead of your meat, you know, and it's just that whole process. But then you've got to have, it's not just about the salt wall. It's a combination of that. We have dehumidifier in there as well, which is then keeping everything else dry. So the room's not wet, you know, and then we've got UV filters, which is cleaning the air. So you always have your light, you never have your lights on in the fridge. These UV filters are running all the time and they're just constantly cleaning the air. So the air's clean. So you've got just good bacteria in there, basically.
And how long do you age your meat for?
We used to age beef for about a year. We don't do that anymore because we're using Japanese. And the Japanese stuff, unfortunately, you can't buy on the bone at the moment. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever be able to buy on the bone because obviously European laws, isn't it, with mad cow disease and all the rest of it, you just can't buy anything older than 30 months.
Right.
So this Japanese stuff doesn't come in on the bone. It comes, it's all off the bone. So you can't age it as long. We dip it in beeswax to try and slow the process down. So we'll let it age on the shelf for a few weeks to dry out, and then we'll dip it in beeswax, and that kind of, it carries an aging, but a lot slower, as if it was on the bone. But meat, not so long as we do. Fish is kind of our thing now, like aging. We age our tuna, so we buy bluefin tuna. It's incredible, sustainably farmed bluefin tuna. Absolutely the best. And we age this for anywhere from 10 days to 20 to 30 days. It's absolutely insane. We age mackerels for 7 days. They're unbelievable on the bone. You know, we age turbots. Yeah, so I love aging fish. It's kind of like my next thing, really. But the salt chamber and the whole aging thing is just, it's just removing moisture. Like, you've got a piece of fish that's fresh and you eat it and it's, yeah, you go, yeah, it's delicious. But you put that in the meat, in the salt chamber for a week and take it out, and all that excess moisture is being dragged out of it. And then you just get this awesome, oily piece of beautiful fish that just melts in the mouth. And you're like, that is like completely changed in 10 days. It's the most unbelievable thing I've ever eaten. And that's kind of what I love about the salt chamber.
It sounds unbelievable. I want to get on a plane and come over now. I'm going to go and tell my husband that we've got to find a week somewhere and just kind of do a trek around there.
Yeah, definitely. Need to come.
Yeah, I would love to. So do you have any desire to open a second location, or is this it for you?
I want to turn, because obviously I don't know if you know much about where we are. We've got like 14.5 acres of land. So we've got loads of like, it's far too much land for a 24-hour restaurant. Like, it's a joke, to be honest.
Right.
So I'm always looking at ways of trying to make the land pay for itself. So over lockdown, we've put 3 teepees up. And at least that pays for the gardener, you know, like looking after the land, and that'll cover that cost so the restaurant's not having to do it. You know, and then I've always wanted to open a bakery, but it'll all be done with it, because we've got loads of buildings, like old barns and stuff that are literally just sat there doing nothing. Yeah, so I want to open a bakery, I want to open a shop.
Yeah.
But the first thing we're going to do is a pub. So I'm going to open a pub out the back.
Okay.
Hopefully next year, and that'll be more for the locals. We're doing a little trial one at the moment in the garden. We put up a stretch tent over a lockdown, just in case, like, because we didn't know what the rules were going to be when we came out the other end. So we put a stretch tent up, and we've built a bar in there, and it's got seating and tables. And then obviously we're back up and running and open. So we thought, let's test it out as a pub. So 2 days a week it runs as a pub in there. We're doing just small plates of food and drinks, and it's going really well.
Oh, amazing! So
it's a good little trial for that, yeah.
Oh, fab. It sounds like you're going to have builders in for a while with, you know, the constant changes. But I love that you're constantly evolving and growing. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I want it to be like, I want it to be like a community. I want like holiday lets, and I want it to become this like almost like village, you know. And like the village that we live in doesn't have anything. It doesn't have a pub, doesn't have a bakery, doesn't have anything like that. Doesn't have a shop. So I like imagine having all these things on your doorstep all of a sudden. You know, it'd be amazing, you know, like.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be absolutely.
Something special about walking out your door and going to the pub, isn't it? And not having to drive there, you know, it's like, one of my boys has just moved out of staff accommodation, and he's moved into a village beside the sea called Borth. And I said to him, it'll change your life. Since I used to live there, you know, and like, you can go out your door, you can go to the shop. You've got 3 pubs to go to, you know, like, you've got the sea right next to you. It's like, something very special about that, you know. We live on site, so everything that me and Amelia want to do, we've got to get in the car.
Yeah.
You know, it's just annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. It's nice to, you know, get on your feet and walk in. If it's like a nice little village, then definitely.
It'll be nice for the guys in the village. I mean, they're loving it. They're walking up here every Friday, Saturday. See them walking across the garden, going down to the tent for a few drinks. It's class. Yeah. I love seeing that.
Well, this sounds like a really long, long-term plan of yours. And I heard in the interview that we spoke about that you wanted to retire in Ibiza.
Yeah, one day I will live there.
One day you will, for sure.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
And do you think that you'll, will you actually like open another location there, or is it completely?
I mean, I hope I'll not have to.
We'll but see. You love what we'll you see. Do, though.
I do love what I do, but I don't want to do it forever.
I'm going to do it forever. Okay.
I want to chill, man. Like, I've been working. I've been a chef for 25 years now. I'm tired, man. You know, I mean, I know there's still time. I've still got plenty in me. I'm not going to give up yet. But like, I don't want to be doing it. If I'm still cooking when I'm 60, I've fucked up somewhere. You know what I mean?
Or you've changed your mind and you really love it.
Yeah. I want to do some stuff. I want to see some stuff. Like, I've always said that, like, because you get a lot of these, you know, when like a chef gets to the point where he stops working in his own kitchen and kind of lets somebody else be the head chef, but never takes his name off the business or never really lets go, and it becomes really confusing. And it's hard, like, I've been in kitchens where it's really hard to work for that chef as a head chef, because you're like, well, it's my food, but it's his name, and like, I want to get my own recognition, or he's changing my dishes, or like, oh, what's going on here? And it's horrible. So I've always said that, like, the day I've had enough in this year, and if I'm lucky enough by then to have bought it outright, which I do plan on doing, but I do plan on getting the rest of the shares one day, I will just back it. Like, I'm being back now. Like, John Talbot doesn't get involved with anything I do. Doesn't tell me what to cook. Doesn't tell me what to do with the restaurant. Doesn't tell me anything. Just rings me up once in a blue moon and goes, how you doing, mate? And I'm like, yeah, good, man, you? Yeah, I'm awesome. Thanks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You busy? Yeah, we're all right. We're really busy, mate. Oh, that's awesome. Well done. You know what I mean? That's all the conversation we have. And I want it to be very much similar. Like, when I do walk away from in a seer, I walk away and I do that. And I'm like, whoever is in charge at the time, which I mean, I've got a couple of guys that I would love to take it on in the future if they wanted it. It's their kitchen, it's their name, it's yours, mate. I'm not telling you what to cook. You cook whatever you want to cook. Just don't ruin it, please.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know what I mean? Yeah. Get it to what it is. So of course you want someone to take over and either make it just better.
But that's my job, is to make sure I employ somebody for that job that doesn't, I can 100% trust. I mean, because I want them to make it better. Like, if I never, like, we're a one-star restaurant now. If we never ever go any further than that, I want that next person to do it. You know, because like, of course, you want them people to get better than you. You know, you want them people to do better than you. It's so if that's the case. Well, yeah, well, I will just hand it over and I'll move to Ibiza and I'll just give you a ring whenever I think of you.
Do you think that comes with shareholding though? So if you want someone to take it over, you'd probably have to sell your share a little bit.
Because it'll become a shareholder
with ownership, doesn't it?
Of course it does. You can't, like, what? Obviously, if I didn't have any shares at all in this year, it would be very different, wouldn't it? Because it's not mine. Like, obviously, I've got responsibilities, you know? Like, I've got to make it work because my life's... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know? Well, when you haven't got ownership of something, it's a very different story, isn't it?
Very different.
That's the way I try and teach my boys all the time, like, when they're breaking something or they're throwing stuff in the bin that they shouldn't be throwing in the bin, I'm like, you might think that I'm being picky now. I said, but when that's yours, you will think twice about throwing that in the bin. I says, because that is money. You know what I mean? And, you know, like, at the end of the day, it's doesn't matter how much or what your business is, like, you're still money. It's still everything costs. You know, and like, people don't realize how much things do cost. And when you tell them, they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, mate. Yep. So you need to think twice about breaking that or treating that the way you do treat it. You know, when you treat everything with respect, treat it as if it's yours. And if you would spend that much money on that, you wouldn't have treated that piece of kit like that.
Yeah. Teach them the accounts.
Yeah.
I was talking to Tom Booton the other day, and he was saying that, you know, he was with Ollie Dabu for a short period of time, and Ollie, he basically, you know, teaches you about costs and, you know, what it costs to do X, Y, Z. And Tom was saying it's probably one of the best lessons that he's been able to take on, because, you know, it's not just about the food, it's about running the business, and you need to know the side of things to make things work. It kind of goes in a big circle.
Yeah, of course it does.
Yeah.
Of course it does.
Gareth, tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
Tell me something about myself that you couldn't possibly know. Well, that's a good one, that one. We'll come back to that. I'll think about it. Move on.
That's my last signature question.
Is it? Is that your last question? What do you want to know? You tell me what you want to know and I'll tell you about it.
I want to know a secret.
secret. I love pot noodles.
You love pot noodles?
I do love pot noodles, yeah. That's not a good, that's not,
I wasn't expecting that's not, that.
That's not a good secret, though.
Is it not?
No. A lot of my secrets, I can't tell you.
I heard actually in the staff canteen interview again, this is quite funny, you hide onion rings in the shower. Well, you like to eat onion rings in the shower.
He made that up.
Did he make it up?
Yeah.
Really?
I love onion rings, but I don't love onion rings that much.
I was thinking this is some serious love for onion rings. I'm glad you said he made it up, because
that's a secret that you didn't know.
That is a secret I didn't know. Gareth, it's been so awesome chatting with you today. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And obviously, we've spoken about this. You're not on social media. I usually promote your Instagram handle. But in this case, should we just...
You can still go to Inisea.
Inisea?
Amelia still does Inisea's. Perfect. I have nothing to do with it at all.
Okay.
So, but it's still, obviously, we made it. I did want to quit the whole lot, but Amelia wouldn't let me.
Okay. All right. You still got Anissa. So they can find your beautiful food there. And I'm at Posh Nosh Girl. If you guys enjoyed today's interview, please rate, review, and subscribe. It helps others find me.